I do feel everyone is being super served by...
Super served.
Absolutely.
Super-sized.
I mean, this is the fourth take that we're providing.
Thoroughly Morgan Spurlocked.
Also known as...
Question Smashtions.
Looking forward to that live rendition of Question Smashtions when we turn up at the Union Chapel in London. Tickets available on the website. Jai says, Dear Restroom and Comfort Break, firstly, a schmancer to Simon's schmestion from a previous episode. On Fridays, when Take One and Take Two drop together, I like to separate the two with another podcast. There is a technology-related podcast that drops their weekly episode on a Wednesday evening, along with a bonus episode as well. I tend to save theirs until Friday, and then I interleave your Take One and Take Two with their main show, and finally a bonus episode. And I have a schmestion of my own. Last year, in the run-up to your Halloween live show, there was a very cool piece of creepy music and sounds that you used to promote the event. Simon used a term for this to cue up the fabulous production staff to play the piece. Pause while I go back to show from October to double check. Called it a sweeper. At the time, I Googled it and discovered it is a term for a pre-recorded promo or station ident. But I've not been able to find out why it's called a sweeper. Does anyone know from where this term originates? Or is it lost to the ages? Or at the very least, does Simon have an answer as amusing as his reasoning from last month that the dial on a volume or fader is called a pot because of the shape of the knob used to turn the potentiometer underneath? Ahaha. I would say a sweeper is a sweeper because it sweeps from one... it's very, very... prosaic answer. It sweeps you from
one thing to another,
from one bit in the show to another. And maybe it changes the tone. So it might go high to low, or it might go fast to slow, or it might be medium to fast. So it sweeps, literally does what it says on the tin.
I mean, this is your profession. You've lived in this world forever. So I'm going to take that as a.
That is what I assume.
Yeah, and I'm still saying that pots is because it's potentiometers.
Hilarious. Anyway, Scott in Cardiff. During Mark's recent review of Women Talking, he explained how he had watched it three times and appreciated it more with every viewing.
Yes.
When COVID hit, I started rewatching films, some of my favourite films, and I still felt strongly about most of them. But there was an odd film, most notably Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which surprisingly left me cold. Here's the question. Does Mark have any examples of films that he initially loved but later fell out of love with? It's interesting because some movies, it's the other way around. But movies that you thought were great, but then on rewatching, were disappointed.
Yeah, it has happened. I've said before, I think there's a film called Golden Door, which I remember reviewing for The Observer and being very glowing about, and then bumped into it on Channel 4 some years later and thought, oh, I'll start watching this because I remember giving it a good review, and then going, oh, this is not as good as I thought it was, is it? I mean, not that it was bad, but it just... And I think that what this feeds into is the fact that people say that, you know, what critics are always doing is slagging things off. It's not true. If you go into the weekly film screenings list, what you're actually looking for is the stuff to celebrate, the stuff to be excited about. Like, great, this week I had Rye Lane and Pearl. But there have been weeks in which, you know, everything is okay, and then you find the one thing that's maybe a little bit more interesting, and you tend to... You tend to sort of big it up, because otherwise you just... I mean, there'd be nothing more boring than us doing a review show in which every single movie you said, what did I think? And I went, well, it's all right if you like that sort of thing. So it does happen. It happens quite a lot. The one that it happened most recently, and I'm sorry because I know this kind of gets a bit of a negative response, is because some work that the good lady Professor Her Indoors was doing, we went back and rewatched the Indiana Jones movies. And I thought they were ropey as all heck.
Okay.
I mean, I was really surprised by how poor I thought particularly the second installment was.
Mark Osmond, who is one of two of the Turks and Caicos vanguard, and we're both called Mark. So he lives in the Turks and Caicos Islands, British Overseas Territories, as you know, in the Northwest Indies. Long-term listener, Radio 1, Vanguard Easter and second-time emailer. As I mentioned in a previous emergency mail, I have lived the wrong side of the Atlantic for nearly two decades in a country with no cinema. Which is interesting. I looked this up. So Turks and Caicos have 57,196 people live in there.
And no cinema.
Someone's missing a trick. Anyway, while I do try to keep up with as much cinema as possible, it is often on a small screen. On my fairly regular trips to London, time is often short or already booked. I am in the unusual situation of being in London to supervise the revision of Child 1 and Child 2, while Mrs. O takes Child 3 and Child 4 for a trip away and give quiet revision time. I am therefore in London for 10 days around Easter with free time. I'm after your recommendations for how best to spend that time in cinema or cinema-adjacent activities. Now, obviously, I have my ticket booked for BFI Kermode Live on the 3rd, but how best to fill the rest of my time? I'm considering Dungeons & Dragons at the IMAX on the understanding that while it might be complete bobbins, it will be spectacular...
Big bobbins.
Spectacular bobbins on the biggest screen. All thoughts gratefully received, preferable things that are not already sold out. Down with history revisionists and up with free speech and hello to Joseph.
I was going to say that Dance Craze is, which we were talking about before, Dance Craze is a document, well, it's not a documentary, it's a music film, but you know, concert film from 1979, 1980 with Specials, Madness, Selector, The Beat, Body Snatchers, shot on Super 35, which was then blown up to 70. They've just done a restoration of it. It's coming out on Blu-ray, I think next month, but they are doing screenings of it at the BFI IMAX. And they've gone back to the original NEG and they've redone the sound. And but I'm pretty certain that that's going to be sold out. But that's something that's well worth. If you can get a ticket for that, that'll be an absolute humdinger. I mean, certainly if you're going to be anywhere near the BFI IMAX in London, that is the largest screen in all of EVS. And it is a fantastic cinema to see anything on. As I said, I'm going back this Sunday to see Shazam, Fury of the Gods, because the good lady Professor Herindorz is taking some students there. And it's to do with the fact that it doesn't matter if they were showing the, you know, a public information film. It wouldn't matter because the screen's so big. There's a Jerzy Skolimowski season at the BFI. If you get a chance and you're near the BFI, sorry to keep doing BFI stuff, you might be able to see Jan Dielman on the big screen. They've been turning people away from performances of that. That was recently voted greatest film of all time in the Sight and Sound poll. And if you can get to see that on a big screen, it is 3 hours, 20 minutes of your life, but it's, you know, it's worth doing it.
Lewis Merritt from Exeter. I'm a long-term listener, first-time writer. I'm a second-year film studies student at the University of Exeter.
Well, there is no finer university.
I left the pause there.
Thank you very much.
I got to meet Mark last March on my film studies field trip to London, where he showed us around Soho.
I'm doing that again on Sunday.
Which is the film capital of the UK. I thought the tour was very interesting and informative. I've already booked a ticket for your live podcast show in May.
Fantastic.
And I'm very much looking forward to seeing your show live. Question for Mark. As a film critic, what are your opinions on The Shining? It is one... which I know the answer to this... it is one of my favourite films and regarded as one of the best horror films of all time. But I've always wondered what Mark's thoughts are on the film. Question for Simon, who has been your most favourite person to interview? So you go first.
Well, weirdly, there's a connection between The Shining and Dance Craze, which is that Joe Dunton, who is the cinematographer, who's using Steadicam, he was using Steadicam 9 on Dance Craze, and Steadicam was first used on Shining. He did 4 or 5 movies, I think, with Stanley Kubrick. I mean, John Carpenter had used the Panaglide before that, but Steadicam really begins with Shining. I think individual elements of The Shining are remarkable. I think that Wendy Carlos's music is extraordinary. I think that it's not the masterpiece that perhaps some other people think it could be. I think there's a very interesting interpretation of it being a film about, you know, domestic abuse and alcoholism above all things, which of course is not really what the Stephen King novel is about, although it does have that in it. If you've ever seen that film Room 237, which does all the kind of, you know, the myriad interpretations of The Shining, I find that fascinating, and I just think the way it looks is extraordinary. My problem is that Jack Nicholson's character, the Torrance character, is mad from the word go. When he's doing the thing at the beginning, when he says, well, you know, yeah, you know, some people, they go up there and they go a bit crazy. And he goes, well, that's not going to be. And you go, yeah, you already look like Jack, you know, you're already at level 5. And there is all the onstage footage of, you know, of Shelley Duvall being treated appallingly, also to get a performance out of her. But really, do you really have to do that together? So I think it's flawed, but I think it's interesting. Your favorite interview?
Well, I mean, I try not to repeat myself, but after all these years, it's quite difficult. Obviously, from this program, Hanks, I mean, Tom, as I call him, just because he always has mastered the art of how to promote a movie and makes you think that for the 20 minutes you're in the room that he's your best friend and you're his best friend, and he does this exactly the same thing with the next person. Spielberg is always fantastic to interview and always very insightful and generous. Chadwick Boseman, for the last 5 minutes of when he was talking to us about 21 Bridges. Is it 21 Bridges?
Yeah, but then that's the thing when you raised the thing about Scorsese's comments about Marvel.
Yes.
And he just does this incredibly eloquent off the cuff.
It's still out there, but it's still worth listening. And from elsewhere, Bruce Springsteen, because it was just, and also that's probably the only time that I'll get to interview Springsteen. And I knew that when I was doing the interview. So you just enjoy the moment far more. And again, very generous and with the most fantastic laugh. So much in life is about, if you've got a fantastic laugh, you'll get away with a lot of stuff. And he
is that what you like about me?
Well, no, I admire, I admire you for other things.
But I have got a good laugh though.
Have you?
Okay.
Anyway, Lewis, thank you for that. Ian from Nautical South London. I can't decide whether it's a question or a smestion. Maybe I'm showing my age being a 90s baby, but I always wonder whether the story of Titanic, Daddy, It's a Ship, was really in the public consciousness before Titanic the movie. Would the average Joe have had much familiarity of the doomed vessel beforehand? Yes.
Yeah.
Maybe you two can shed some light. What with you being so old? I'm just adding that in.
You know, it was hugely, I mean, the very first film of the Titanic disaster came out in the same year as the Titanic disaster. Yes. And there have been several, I mean, it's been in the popular consciousness. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the word Titanic has been, I mean, obviously it's sort of, it's like a shorthand.
Yes.
For catastrophe. Also, my question or question is, what other films have had an impact similar to Titanic in regards to keeping the story of a historical event alive in the minds of the public?
Well, one could argue that Saving Private Ryan probably did more to bring a modern audience up to speed with just what was involved in D-Day than,
yes,
you know, than history. And it's interesting because when I was at school, I did my history project on D-Day for my O-level thing. And I was the first project long-form essay I'd ever done. And I spent 2 weeks in the library, you know, researching. 2 weeks in the library when you're young is quite a lot. And proving that actually we should have lost. Because, of course, strategically, we should have lost. Strategically, D-Day should not have worked.
Also,
even with the stunning loss of life, it shouldn't have. And that kind of came up more recently in the movies about Churchill. Sorry, you were saying.
No, I was just going to say Dunkirk, you could offer.
Yeah. That's probably a better
parallel picture. Also, Apollo 13.
Yes, again, I saw it with Wendy Eyde. Not with Wendy Eyde, with Wendy Lloyd, who brilliantly said she loved it because she didn't know how it worked out in the end.
Exactly. So there's a whole bunch of others. Let's just do this one. From Kate. First things first, thank you for delivering consistently top quality content on a weekly basis. The world is a better place for it. Also, well done to the amazing production team for all their hard work and for making the show what it is. I have to say, none of them are listening at this point. They're all watching. Oh, yeah. They're watching YouTube or stuff. No, so question. Mark, I just heard you speaking about your failed attempt to purchase Eurovision tickets on this week's Extra Take.
Yes.
I give you my condolences. I'm also an unfortunate Eurovision fan who missed out on the opportunity to see one of my favourite things ever, second only to your good selves, live in the flesh. No doubt thanks to the Johnny-come-latelys who managed to nab undeserved tickets.
Yes, they should have had a quiz. You should have had to do a Eurovision quiz to get tickets.
I agree with you that a quiz would have been a much more appropriate way to distribute the tickets to those who deserved it most. So on this topic, I'm wondering who your favourite Eurovision act of all time is and why.
I'm inclined to say Ya-Ya Ding Dong.
Who did Ya-Ya? No.
No, it's because it's the Will Ferrell thing. You know?
Oh, right.
You know,
okay.
Play Ya-Ya Ding Dong. Of all time, well, Naff as it surely is, I remember as a child watching ABBA doing, well, I'm sorry, I know that it's the open door answer, but I remember watching them. I stayed up with my mum and dad to watch it, and because they had the bubble perms and the loon pants and the boots.
Doing
and
Waterloo.
Yeah, and I just thought, pop music is the best thing in the whole world. Why is it on Eurovision? Because at that point it was, you know, we were coming out of the boom, bang, a bang, ding, dang, a dong thing. And then suddenly, ABBA. So I know it's the Naff answer. I'd love to give you something far more obscure than that. But ABBA winning for Waterloo was...
The Icelandic... Icelandic... I think it's Daddy Freyr who did the video for Think About Things, which I think they had to do by video, if I remember right, because of COVID. Anyway, that was particularly weirdly extraordinary in a very Icelandic way. Brotherhood of Man is apparently the biggest seller. Save Your Kisses for Me, of all the Eurovision songs, has sold the most. But there is a conclusive winner, I think, to this question, which is the 1958 Italian entry.
Which is Volare. Yeah.
But also probably should be called Nel Blu Dipinto di Blu, yeah. In the Blue Sky, sung by Domenico Modugno, because that...
has now become anthemic.
Exactly. And actually, at the first Grammys ever in 1959, won Record of the Year and Song of the Year.
There we go.
So I would think...
That's very good.
Volare has lasted the longest. Now... I'm going to have to take my headphones off.
I'm going to take mine as well because I didn't get it.
Because the redactor is now singing Arsenal propaganda into my headphones, and I don't need to hear any of that.
One of my favourite moments in the film of The Wanderers, the Philip Kaufman film of The Wanderers, when they're doing the thing about they're trying to get the classes, get, you know, all these sort of different, you know, tribes in it, and he's saying, okay, fine, kind of let's, you know, they kind of separate them up, and then he says, you know, Italians here, and the Italians go, hey! And then they go, Volare!
That's the one.
It's just genius.
More questions and schmestions, please send them to correspondence@curbadomeo.com. Book for our live show on the website for a live question smash edition, by which time we'll know how to say it properly.